The next subheading is Matthew Arnold. Eliot did not agree with Arnold as critic. He regarded his criticism as too dry, abstract, intellectual, and devoid of emotion. However, he has great admiration for Arnold, the poet. I have elsewhere tried to point out some of Arnold's weaknesses. When he ventured into departments of thought for which his mind was unsuited and ill-equipped. In philosophy and theology, he was an undergraduate in religion of Philistine. It is a pleasanter task to define a man's limitations within the field in which he is qualified, for there the definition of limitation may be at the same time a precision of the writer's excellences. Arnold's poetry has little technical interest. It is academic poetry in the best sense, the best fruit which can issue from the promise sown by the prize poem. When he is not simply being himself, he is most at ease in a master's gown. Empedocles on Etna is one of the finest academic poems ever written. He tried other robes which became him less well. I cannot but think of Tristram and Iseult and the Forsaken Mermen as charades. Sohrab and Rustam is a fine piece, but less fine than Gebir, and in the classical line, Landor, with a finer ear, can beat Arnold every time. But Arnold is a poet to whom one readily returns. It is a pleasure, certainly after associating with the riff-raff of the early part of the century, to be in the company of a man qui sat se conjure, but Arnold is something more than an agreeable professor of poetry. With all his fastidiousness and superciliousness and officiality, Arnold is more intimate with us than Browning, more intimate than Tennyson ever is expected at moments, as in the passionate flights in memoriam. He is the poet and critic of a period of false stability. All his writing in the kind of literature and dogma seems to me a valiant attempt to dodge the issue, to mediate between Newman and Huxley. But his poetry, the best of it, is too honest to employ any but his genuine feelings of unrest, loneliness, and dissatisfaction. Some of his limitations are manifest enough. In his essay on the study of poetry, he has several paragraphs on Burns, and for an Englishman, the Englishman of his time, Arnold understands Burns very well. Perhaps I have a partiality for a small, oppressed nationalities like the Scots that makes Arnold's patronizing manner irritate me, and certainly I suspect Arnold of helping to fix the wholly mistaken notion of Burns as a singular, untutored English dialect poet instead of as a decadent representative of a great alien tradition. But he says that no one can deny that it is of advantage to a poet to deal with a beautiful world, and this remark strikes me as betraying a limitation. It is an advantage to mankind in general to live in a beautiful world, and that no one can doubt. But for the poet, is it so important? We mean all sorts of things, I know, by beauty. But the essential advantage for a poet is not to have a beautiful world with which to deal. It is to be able to see beneath both beauty and ugliness, to see the boredom and the horror and the glory. Here, Arnold is compared to Tennyson, Browning, and a number of other poets. His limitations are pinpointed, but his merit also is recognized. He alone is the poet to whom one readily returns, for his poetry gives pleasure, the pleasure arising from the intimacy between the poet and his reader. Though in this essay the tone is one of the frank admiration, in another essay in which Eliot dealt with Arnold, the critic, his views are colored by extraneous considerations. Eliot stoops to personal invective and reveals his personal prejudice when he calls Arnold a propagandist of literature and an overworked school inspector. Then the next subheading is Eliot's critical methods. In the light of the practical criticism examined above, Eliot's critical methods may be summed up as follows. First, Eliot's style forms an important aspect of his critical method. As M.C. Brandbook points out, his style is a neutral style, expository rather than forensic. It works through negatives and definition by exclusion. It is devoid of emotional phrase and metaphor, and underneath it runs a delightful current of humor and irony. He does not state or describe anything in detail. He works by reserves and implications. Much more is implied than what is directly asserted. In this way, he is able to secure the lively cooperation of his readers. They are active participants and not mere passive receivers of the opinion of the critic. His style is reserved and restricted, and his prose is marked by precision and exactitude. Then, point number two. Another aspect of Eliot's style is his use of quotations. The quotations are made to do the critic's work, and the reader is made to work on them. It is the statement of Bradbrook. They are exactly chosen to make the point at which Eliot aims. They stamp themselves on the mind of the reader and easily pass into general circulation. They are thought-provoking. They make the reader think, and in this way, this active cooperation is secured. Point number three. Eliot tries to be as exact and precise as possible. In order to convey his meanings accurately, he makes frequent use of conditional and qualifying phrases. In this way, he says exactly and accurately what he has to say. He avoids all superfluity. He is compact, sharp, and to the point. Attention is focused throughout on the key points and a few significant phrases in a writer's work, and all that is unessential is excluded. Then point number four. Irony and devastating wit are potent instruments in the hands of Eliot. Sometimes he does not counter an argument but treats it with mocking irony. Fifth, he does not pass any judgments of worse and better. He simply elucidates and leaves the readers to form their own judgments. He simply analyzes and places the facts before his readers without commenting on those facts. Point number 6. Comparison is an important aspect of Eliot's critical method. But the purpose of his comparison is to elucidate and analyze, never to determine good and bad. He compares only to elucidate and not to interpret the facts. Then point number 7. Eliot avoids all digressions, biographical, historical, or sociological. No doubt, much extraneous prejudice colors and spoils his destructive criticism. This is particularly so in the case of his criticism of Milton and Arnold. However, with few exceptions, he can appreciate even writers who are uncongenial to him, and his sincerity and integrity are above doubt. Then the next heading is Eliot's achievement as a practical critic. Eliot's achievement as a practical critic has been of far-reaching importance. He has brought about a revolution in taste. As a result of his criticism, there has been a revaluation of poets like Marlowe, Johnson, Dunne, Donne, and many others. The metaphysicals were appreciated merely by a few scholars, but thanks to Eliot, they are now appreciated even by the young undergraduate. The credit for metaphysical revival in the early 20th century must go to T.S. Eliot. Similarly, the renewed interest in Ben Jonson and Dryden is a sort of personal triumph for Mr. Eliot. His essay on Dante has been followed not only by considerable general interest in the Italian poet, but also by an enthusiasm for the later Middle Ages. Above all, as a practical critic, Eliot has set a standard and displayed a method. His criticism, therefore, is of permanent value, and all attempts to run down his critical achievement have so far remained futile. Then point number 4. Tradition and individual talent. Critical synopsis. Eliot's theory of poetry and the poetic process. Impersonality of poetry. Manifesto of Eliot's critical creed. The essay Tradition and Individual Talent was first published in 1919 in the Times Literary Supplement as a critical article. The essay may be regarded as an unofficial manifesto of Eliot's critical creed, for it contains all those critical principles from which his criticism has been derived ever since. The seeds which have been sown here come to fruition, fruition, in his subsequent essays. It is a declaration of Eliot's critical creed, and these principles are the basis of all his subsequent criticism. The next subheading is its three parts. The essay is divided into three parts. The first part gives us Eliot's concept of tradition, and in the second part is developed his theory of the impersonality of poetry. The short third part is the nature of conclusion or summing up of the whole discussion. The other subheading is the significance of tradition. Eliot begins by pointing out that the word tradition is generally regarded as a term of censure. It sounds disagreeable to the English ears. When the English praise a poet, they praise him for those aspects of his work which are individual and original. It is supposed that his chief merits lie in such parts. This undue stress on individuality shows that the English have an uncritical turn of mind. They praise the poet for the wrong thing. If they examine the matter critically with an unprejudiced mind, they will realize that the best and the most individual part of a poet's work is that which shows the maximum influence of the writers of the past. To quote his own words, "Whereas if we approach a poet without his prejudice, we shall often find that not only the best but the most individual parts of his work may be those in which the dead poets, his ancestors, assert their immortality most vigorously." The next subheading is tradition, ways in which it can be acquired. This brings Eliot to a consideration of the value and significance of tradition. Tradition does not mean a blind adherence to the ways of the previous generation or generations. This would be mere slavish imitation, a mere repetition of what has already been achieved, and novelty is better than repetition. Tradition in the sense of passive repetition is to be discouraged. For Eliot, tradition is a matter of much wider significance. Tradition in the true sense of the term cannot be inherited. It can only be obtained by hard labor. This labor is the labor of knowing the past writers. It is the critical labor of sifting the good from the bad and of knowing what is good and useful. Tradition can be obtained only by those who have the historical sense. The historical sense involves a perception not only of the pastness of the past but also of its presence. One who has the historic sense feels that the whole of the literature of Europe from Homer down to his own day, including the literature of his own country, forms one continuous literary tradition. He realizes that the past exists in the present and that the past and present form one simultaneous order. This historical sense is the sense of the timeless and the temporal, as well as of the timeless and the temporal together. It is this historic sense which makes a writer traditional. A writer with the sense of tradition is fully conscious of his own generation, of his place in the present, but he is also actually conscious of his relationship with the writers of the past. In brief, sense of tradition implies a recognition of the continuity of literature, b, a critical judgment as to which of the writers of the past continue to be significant in the present, and c, a knowledge of these significant writers obtained through painstaking effort. Tradition represents the accumulated wisdom and experience of ages, and so its knowledge is essential for really great and noble achievements. The next subheading is dynamic conception of tradition. Emphasizing further the value of tradition, Eliot points out that no writer has his value and significance in isolation. To judge the work of a poet or an artist, we must compare and contrast his work with the work of poets and artists in the past. Such comparison and contrast is essential for forming an idea of the real worth and significance of a new writer and his work. Eliot's conception of tradition is a dynamic one. According to his view, tradition is not anything fixed and static. It is constantly changing, growing, and becoming different from what it is. A writer in the present must seek guidance from the past. He must conform to the literary tradition. But just as the past directs and guides the present, so the present alters and modifies the past. When a new work of art is created, it is really new and original. The whole literary tradition is modified, though ever so slightly. The relationship between the past and the present is not one-sided. It is a reciprocal relationship. The past directs the present and is itself modified and altered by the present. To quote the words of Eliot himself, the existing monuments form an ideal order among themselves, which is modified by the introduction of the new work of art among them. The existing order is complete before the new work arrives, for order to persist after the supervention of novelty, the whole existing order must be, if ever so slightly, altered. Every great poet like Virgil, Dante, or Shakespeare adds something to the literary tradition out of which the future poetry will be written. Then the next subheading, its function. The work of a poet in the present is to be compared and contrasted with works of the past and judged by the standards of the past. But this judgment does not mean determining good or bad. It does not mean deciding whether the present work is better or worse than works of the past. An author in the present is certainly not to be judged by the principles and standards of the past. The comparison is to be made for knowing the facts, all the facts about the new work of art. The comparison is made for the purposes of analysis and for the forming a better understanding of the new. Moreover, this comparison is reciprocal. The past helps us to understand the present, and he throws light on the past. It is in this way alone that we can form an idea of what is really individual and new. It is by comparison alone that we can sift the traditional from individual elements in a given work of art. Then the next subheading is sense of tradition. Eliot now explains further what he means by a sense of tradition. The sense of tradition does not mean that the poet should try to know the past as a whole, take it to be a lump or mass without any discrimination. Such a course is impossible as well as undesirable. The past must be examined critically, and only the significant in it should be acquired. The sense of tradition does not also mean that the poet should know only a few poets whom he admires. This is a sign of immaturity and inexperience. Neither should a poet be content merely to know some particular age or period which he likes. This may be pleasant and delightful, but it will not constitute a sense of tradition. A sense of tradition in the real sense means consciousness of the main current, which does not all flow invariably through the most distinguished reputations. In other words, to know the tradition, the poet must judge critically what are the main trends and what are not. We must confine himself to the main trends of the exclusion of all that is incidental or topical. The poet must possess the critical gift in ample measure. He must also realize that the main literary trends are not determined by the great poets alone. Smaller poets also are significant. They are not to be ignored. The poet must also realize that art never improves. Though its material is never the same, the mind of Europe may change, but this change does not mean that great writers like Shakespeare and Homer have grown outdated and lost their significance. The great works of art never lose their significance, for there is no qualitative improvement in art. There may be refinement, there may be development, but from the point of view of the artist, there is no improvement. For example, it will not be correct to say that the art of Shakespeare is better and higher than that of Eliot. Their works are of different kinds, for the material on which they worked was different. T.S. Eliot is conscious of the criticism that will be made of his theory of tradition. His view of tradition requires, it will be said, a ridiculous amount of erudition. It will be pointed out that there have been great poets who were not learned, and further that too much learning kills sensibility. However, knowledge does not merely mean bookish knowledge, and the capacity of acquiring knowledge differs from person to person. Some can absorb knowledge easily, while others must sweat for it. Shakespeare, for example, could know more of Roman history from Plutarch than most men can from the British Museum. It is the duty of every poet to acquire, to the best of his ability, this knowledge of the past, and he must continue to acquire this consciousness throughout his career. Such awareness of tradition sharpens poetic sensibility and is indispensable for poetic creation. The next subheading is Impersonality of Poetry. The artist must continually surrender himself to something which is more valuable than himself, that is, the literary tradition. He must allow his poetic sensibility to be shaped and modified by the past. He must continue to acquire the sense of tradition throughout his career. In the beginning, his self, his individuality may assert itself, but as his powers mature, there must be greater and greater extinction of personality. He must acquire greater and greater objectivity. His emotions and passions must be depersonalized. He must be as impersonal and objective as a scientist. The personality of the artist is not important. The important thing is the sense of tradition. A good poem is a living whole of all the poetry that has ever been written. He must forget his personal joys and sorrows and be absorbed in acquiring a sense of tradition and expressing it in his poetry. Thus, the poet's personality is merely a medium, having the same significance as a catalytic agent or a receptacle in which chemical reactions take place. That is why the poet holds that honest criticism and sensitive appreciation is directed not upon the poet but upon the poetry. The other subheading is the poetic process. In the second part of the essay, Eliot develops further his theory of the impersonality of poetry. He compares the mind of the poet to a catalyst and the process of poetic creation to the process of a chemical reaction. Just as chemical reactions take place in the presence of a catalyst alone, So also the poet's mind is the catalytic agent for combining different emotions into something new. Suppose there is a jar containing oxygen and sulfur dioxide. These two gases combine to form sulfurous acid when a fine filament of platinum is introduced into the jar. The combination takes place only in the presence of the piece of platinum, but the metal itself does not undergo any change. It remains inert, neutral, and unaffected. The mind of the poet is like a catalytic agent. It is necessary for combinations of emotions and experience to take place, but it itself does not undergo any change during the process of poetic combination. The mind of the poet is constantly forming emotions and experiences into new wholes, but the new combination does not contain even a trace of the poet's mind, just as the newly formed sulfurous acid does not contain any trace of platinum. In the case of a young and immature poet, his mind, his personal emotions and experiences may find some expression in his composition, but says Eliot, the more perfect the artist, the more completely separate in him will be the man who suffers and the mind which creates. The test of maturity of an artist is the completeness with which his mind digests and transmutes the passions which form the substance of his poetry. The man suffers, that is, has experiences, but it is his mind which transforms his experiences into something new and different. The personality of the poet does not find expression in his poetry. It acts like a catalytic agent in the process of poetic composition. The experiences which enter the poetic process, say Eliot, may be of two kinds. They are emotions and feelings. Poetry may be composed out of emotions only, out of feelings only, or out of both. T.S. Eliot here distinguishes between the emotions and feelings. But he does not state that this difference is nowhere else in his writings. Says A.G. George, is this distinction maintained? Neither does he adequately distinguish between the meaning of the two words. The distinction should therefore be ignored, more so as it has bearing on his impersonal theory of poetry. Then the next subheading is poetry as organization. Eliot next compares the poet's mind to a jar of receptacle in which are stored numberless feelings, emotions, etc., which remain there in an unorganized and chaotic form till all the particles which can unite to form a new compound are present together. Thus, poetry is organization rather than inspiration, and the greatness of a poem does not depend upon the greatness or even the intensity of the emotions which are components of the poem, but upon the intensity of the process of poetic composition. Just as a chemical reaction takes place under pressure, so also intensity is needed for the fusion of emotions. The more intense the poetic process, the greater the poem. There is always a difference between the artistic emotion and the personal emotions of the poet. For example, the famous Ode to Nightingale of Keats contains a number of emotions which have nothing to do with the nightingale. The difference between art and the event is always absolute. The poet has no personality to express. He is merely a medium in which impressions and experiences combine in peculiar and expected ways. Impressions and experiences which are important for the man may find no place in his poetry, and those which become important in the poetry may have no significance for the man. Eliot thus rejects romantic subjectivism. The emotion of poetry is different from personal emotions of poet. His personal emotions may be simple or crude, but the emotions of his poetry may be complex and refined. It is the mistaken notion that the poet must express new emotions that results in much eccentricity in poetry. It is not the business of the poet to find new emotions. He may express only ordinary emotions, but he must impart to them a new significance and a new meaning. And it is not necessary that they should be in personal emotions. Even emotions which he has never personally experienced can serve the purpose of poetry. For example, emotions which result from the reading of books can serve his turn. Eliot rejects Wordsworth's theory of poetry having its origin in emotions recollected in tranquility, and points out that in the process of poetic composition there is neither emotion nor recollection nor tranquility. In the poetic process there is only concentration of a number of experiences, and a new thing results from this concentration, and this process of concentration is neither conscious nor deliberate. It is a passive one. There is no doubt that there are elements in the poetic process which are conscious and deliberate. The difference between a good and a bad poet is that a bad poet is conscious where he should be unconscious, and unconscious where he should be conscious. It is this consciousness of the wrong kind which makes a poem personal, whereas mature art must be impersonal. But Eliot does not tell us when a poet should be conscious and when not. The point has been left vague and indeterminate. The next subheading is Poetry as Escape from Personality. Eliot concludes, "Poetry is not a turning loose of emotion, but an escape from emotion. It is not the expression of personality, but an escape from personality." Thus, Eliot does not deny personality or emotion to the poet. Only he must depersonalize his emotions. There should be an extinction of his personality. This impersonality can be achieved only when the poet surrenders himself completely to the work that is to be done, and the poet can know what is to be done only if he acquires a sense of tradition, the historic sense which makes him conscious not only of the present but also of the present moments of the past, not only what is dead but of what is already living. Then point fifth, the function of criticism, critical synopsis, definition of criticism, ends of criticism. The origin of the essay, its four parts. The essay function of criticism, 1923, arose out of controversy. Eliot's essay Tradition and Individual Talent was published a few years earlier in 1919. Middleton Murray challenged the opinions of Eliot in his essay Romanticism and the Tradition. The present essay is Eliot's reply to Murray, M-U-R-R-Y. The first part gives in brief the opinions expressed by Eliot in the essay Tradition and Individual Talent. In the second part, he gives a resume of the views of Middleton Murray. In the third part, these views of Murray are briefly dismissed, and in the concluding fourth part, the poet examines the different aspects of the nature and function of criticism. Eliot begins the essay by referring to certain views he had expressed in his earlier essay, Tradition and Individual Talent, because they are relevant to the present essay. In the earlier essay, he had pointed out that there is an intimate relation between the present and the past in the world of literature. The entire literature of Europe, from Homer down to the present day, forms a single literary tradition, and it is in relation to this tradition that individual writers and individual works of art have their significance. This literary tradition is the outside authority to which an artist in the present must owe allegiance. He must constantly surrender and sacrifice himself in order to have meaning and significance. The true artists of any time form an ideal community, and an artist in the present must achieve a sense of this community. He must realize that artists of all times are united together by a common cause and a common inheritance. While a second-rate artist asserts his individuality because his distinction lies in the difference and not in similarity with others, the true artist tries to conform. He alone can afford to collaborate, to exchange, to contribute. Definition of criticism, its ends. Eliot's views on criticism derive from his views on art and tradition as given above. He defines criticism as the commentation and exposition of works of art by means of written words. Criticism can never be an autoletic activity, because criticism is always about something. Art, as critics like Matthew Arnold point out, may have some other ends, for example, moral, religious, cultural. But art need not be aware of these ends. Rather, it performs its function better by being indifferent to such ends. But criticism always has one and only one definite end, and that end is elucidation of works of art and the correction of taste. In his essay, The Frontiers of Criticism, he further explains the aim of criticism as the promotion of understanding and enjoyment of literature. Since the end of criticism is clear and well defined, it should be easy to determine whether a critic has performed his function well or not. However, this is not such an easy task. The difficulty arises from the fact that critics, instead of trying to discipline their personal prejudices and whims and composing their differences with as many of their fellow critics as possible and cooperating in the common pursuit of true judgment, express extreme views and vehemently assert their individuality, that is, the ways in which they differ from others. This is so because they owe their livelihood to such differences and oddities. The result is criticism has become like a Sunday park full of orators competing with each other to attract a large an audience as possible. Such critics are a worthless lot of no value and significance. However, there are certain other critics who are useful, and it is on the basis of their works that Eliot establishes an aims and methods of criticism which should be followed by all. Then the next subheading is criticism of Murray's views. In the second part of the essay, Eliot digresses into a consideration of Middleton Murray's views on classicism and romanticism. While there are critics who hold that the classicism and romanticism are the same thing, Murray takes a definite position and makes a clear distinction between the two and says that one cannot be a classic and a romantic at one and the same time. In this respect, Eliot praises Murray, but he does not agree with him when he makes the issue a national and radical issue and says that the genius of the French is classic and that of the English is romantic. Murray further relates Catholicism in religion with classicism literature. For both believe in tradition, in discipline, in obedience to an objective authority outside the individual. On the contrary, Romanticism and Protestantism and social liberalism are related, for they have full faith in the inner voice in the individual and obey no outside authority. They care for no rules and traditions. Eliot does not agree with these views. In his opinion, the difference between classicism and romanticism is the difference between the complete and the fragmentary, the adult and the immature, the orderly and the chaotic. To him, the concept of inner voice sounds remarkably like doing what one likes. It is a sign of indiscipline leading to vanity, fear, and lust. Neither does he agree with the view that English as a notion are romantics and so humorous and non-conformists, while the French are naturally classical. In the third part of the essay, Eliot summarily dismisses the views of Murray. The tone is one of light ridicule, R-I-D-I-C-U-L-E. He contemptuously, C-O-N-T-E-M-P-T-U-O-U-S-L-Y, he contemptuously calls the inner voice vigory, W-H-I-G-G-E-R-Y. For those who believe in the inner voice, criticism is of no value at all, because the function of criticism is to discover some common principles for achieving perfection in art. Those who believe in the inner voice do not want any principles. In other words, they do not care for perfection in art, which can result only through obedience to the laws of art and to tradition, which represents the accumulated wisdom and the experience of ages. Then the next subheading is criticism and creation. In the fourth part, Eliot deals with the problem of criticism in all its manifold aspects. In the very beginning, he comments upon the terms critical and creative. He ridicules Matthew Arnold for having distinguished rather bluntly between the critical and the creative activity. He does not realize that criticism is of capital importance in the work of creation. As a matter of fact, the larger part of the labor of an author in composing his work is critical labor, the labor of sifting, combining, constructing, expunging, correcting, testing. Eliot further expresses the view that criticism employed by a writer on his own work is the most vital and highest kind of criticism. Elsewhere, Eliot calls such criticism workshop criticism. Its high worth and value cannot be denied, For a poet who knows from personal experience the mysteries of the creative process is in a better position to write about it than those who have no such knowledge. Eliot goes to the extent of saying that some creative writers are superior to others only because their critical faculty is superior. He ridicules those who decry the unconscious artist. He calls such concepts vagary and pours his ridicule on such people. He commends those who, instead of relying on the inner voice or inspiration, conform to tradition and in this way try to make their works as free from defects as possible. It is a mistake to separate critical and creative activities. A large part of creation is in reality criticism. Creative criticism is neither criticism nor creation. It is so because there is a fundamental difference between creation and criticism. Creation, a work of art, is autoletic. It has no conscious aims and objectives. Criticism, on the other hand, is always about something other than itself. In other words, it is not an autoletic activity, its aim being the creation with criticism, as we can fuse criticism with creation. The critical activity finds its highest fulfillment when it is fused with creation, with the labor of the artist. The next subheading is The Critic, His Qualifications. Eliot next proceeds to consider the qualifications of a critic. The foremost quality which an ideal critic must have is a highly developed sense of fact. The sense of fact is a rare gift. It is not frequently met with, and it is very slow to develop. The value of a practitioner's criticism, say that of a poet on his own art, workshop criticism, as Eliot elsewhere calls it, lies in the fact that he is dealing with facts which he understands, and so can also help us to understand them. Eliot's own criticism is such workshop criticism, and Eliot is all praises for such critics and their criticism. There is a large part of criticism which seeks to interpret an author and his work, but most of such interpretation is not an interpretation at all. It is mere fiction. The critic gives his view, his impressions of the work, and so is false and misleading. Eliot has no use for such impressionistic criticism. It gives us no insight into the work under study. True interpretation is no interpretation at all. It is merely putting the reader in possession of the facts which he might have missed otherwise. The true critic himself knows the facts about a work of art, its conditions, its setting, its genesis, and puts them before his readers in a simple and easy manner. Thus, it is clear that the fact Eliot means the various technical aspects of a work of art. Then the next subheading is Tools of a Critic. Comparison and analysis are the chief tools of a critic. These are the tools of a critic, and he must use them with care and intelligence. Comparison and analysis can be possible only when the critic knows the fact about the works which are to be compared and analyzed. He must know the facts about the works of art, technical elements like its structure, content, and theme, and not waste his time in such irrelevant fact-hunting as the inquiry into the number of times giraffes are mentioned in the English novel. However, the method of comparison and analysis, even when used unjudiciously, is preferable to interpretation in the conventional sense.